Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media
would bias. They're more biased.
It's Wednesday, February 29th, Leap Day, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here alongside are Lee Wilkins and Linda Kraxberger, colleagues from the Missouri School of Journalism. Linda sitting in this week for Charles Davis. Well, it doesn't happen often, but this week, three of our four topics are local or have local angles. An MU professor is called out for payments he's received from the climate skeptics at the Heartland Institute. Citizen journalists are turning up the heat on what they see as pro-development bias in mainstream coverage of City Council's decision to declare a large swath of Columbia blighted. And the True-False Festival is back for its ninth annual showcase of the best in documentary films. We'll also consider how newspapers in New York and New Jersey are taking sides over the NYPD's surveillance of area Muslims. Well, last week we discussed the case of the California climate scientist who admitted receiving internal documents from the Libertarian Heartland Institute under false pretenses. Since then, Heartland and the supporters in the conservative press and blogosphere have accused that scientist of forging one of the documents, and Greenpeace, an environmental group that backs the consensus on climate change, has accused several professors around the country of not disclosing payments they've received from Heartland. One of them is Dr. Anthony Lupo, chair of the Soil, Environmental, and Atmospheric Science Department right here at MU. In a story in the Chronicle of Higher Education, Professor Lupo acknowledges receiving $750 a month from Heartland starting in December of 2010. But Lupo says he reported the consulting income as required by the university and doesn't see a conflict of interest for his part in a $300,000 grant from the National Science Foundation that ended before the Heartland payments allegedly began. Well, Lee, Tony Lupo is a well-respected, and at least in some quarters, he's a well-published and award-winning faculty member here at MU. He also believes that there's really no scientific certainty yet about whether man-made climate change has had an impact for the worst on the globe. And so he's documented some of this, the work that he's done for Heartland on his website, on his Vita that's online for everybody to look at. He didn't disclose the payments until this story came out. And so we're just wondering, really, after all of this, assuming he's telling the truth about all of that, the disclosures and such with the university, does he have a conflict of interest problem?
Let me say a couple of things, because I know Tony and have worked with him in a variety of capacities. Tony has every right to his scientific opinion, and I am no expert in science, although I have studied how the media cover this. So I know a little something about how media cover global climate change, but the science within that is not my area of expertise. Based on that, conflict of interest is the only place in ethics where we say and we tell people up front, appearance matters as much as fact. Which is very confusing for folks. Because people can believe lots of things that really aren't rational. They don't have any basis in fact. They're not logical. Having said all of that, Tony has every right to say he doesn't believe he has a conflict of interest. I believe he does. I believe that by taking this money and not disclosing it except as the university requires us to, and the university requires us to disclose from whom we get, but not how much we get. And so by not doing all of that sort of up front, by not being transparent, yes, I think he has a conflict of interest in part because these people have a political agenda that runs quite contrary to scientific opinion at this point.
But let me just follow up a little bit, because he says he did follow the university's procedures in declaring that income. So what additional obligation does he have if he's followed the rules, the conflict of interest rules of the university?
Well, my understanding when I fill out those forms, as we all do once a year, is that I have to write on the form my publisher, so McGraw-Hill, and that what I did, I wrote a book – I never have to report my income. That's on my income tax. But the university has affirmatively said multiple times it doesn't care whether I make 2 cents or $200,000, just so long as I'm reporting. So my assumption based on what Tony has said is that, in fact, he did what I do. He reported Heartland Institute and what he did for them. He did not report the amount of income. He's not required to disclose that. Transparency to me argues that he should. And particularly over an area like this that is so scientifically contentious, particularly from a group that has a political agenda. The parallel that I've used is it's like me taking me getting some sort of monthly retainer, if you will, from Rupert Murdoch to do ethics work without disclosing the fact that it's Rupert Murdoch who's paying me.
I was trying to parse this for myself, and the first thing, you know, I want to stay in the safe zone for me. I don't want to trash a colleague at the University of Missouri, and so I wanted to just sort of jump off in the obtaining of the documents world, which and fabricating of this memo, which is just
well, I'll
horrendous.
Come to that part in just a second. Okay,
I will say this: I was looking in my mind. I'm going to show my naivete in university life here, and that is as a teaching professional who doesn't earn a gigantic salary, $750 a month is a lot of money to many teaching faculty here at our university. And we had a little miniature discussion about how much would it take, you know, I'd like to say I couldn't be bought for that. And I have to say $750 a month, what's it for? Is $750 a month for your science, or is $750 a month to be on retainer to widely purport your opinion in different places? And I think those are two different things. And I think there's some gray area that I'm uncomfortable with in that.
Well, let's pull this back to a little more safe territory and talk about news coverage of this story. I find it really interesting that it was about a week ago that the Chronicle of Higher Education documented this local connection to the story. And yet, from all the searching I've been able to do online so far, not a single Columbia news organization has yet covered this story. Why?
We're terrified.
That's right.
I've leaked it to more than one place. I know for a fact, because I've had some conversations, that the University News Bureau has dealt with this and with more than one media outlet. But in fairness, in just plain flat-out fairness, if we were to deal with this locally, we owe it to Dr. Lupo to allow him to be quoted, to be on camera, and to give his side of it. That's just journalistically
appropriate. Sure, but how many days does it take to do that after the media, local media, have been alerted to the fact that this is a local story?
Well, we'll run the field experiment now, right, Mike?
Right. Linda, I mean, you know, if we thought that this was an important enough, interesting enough story for our audience, couldn't we have turned it by now?
I think we could have turned it by now. And I think the overwhelming weight of the evidence on the science side – so Professor Lupo's science is not the majority opinion in our country and in the world right now. And the problem is one that we have discussed on this program many, many times, which is something that we sometimes call he said, she said journalism. And if we give equal weight to one side of the science as to another side of the science, are we doing justice to a particular story? So I think that is what factoring into this just a little bit is a journalist uncomfortable with not being science journalists and being uncomfortable with that equation.
Well, I certainly think there's that, and I think to be really fair, although Professor Lupo's opinion does not match you know, the rest of the general consensus. It's not a general consensus. It's a very widely held consensus. It's still been peer reviewed. Mm-hmm. It's still his work. He's still allowed to speak his mind. That's how science progresses. Mm-hmm. But Linda's also correct. You know, if every time we said the world is round, we went to the group of people, and they do exist, who believe that the earth is flat, and gave them equal weight, we are not, in my view, we are not being truthful.
Right. I don't dispute any of that, but I do think that the local media should see that this is an interesting story.
Yeah.
Whether it's about, it's not even the story necessarily about his views on climate change. It's about whether or not he took money. He's being accused by environmentalists of taking money. He certainly has not been shy about talking to the media in the past. it seems to me like we should expect to see some stories in the local media at some point in the not too distant future.
And there, I mean, there are good stories to do that use this as sort of a jumping off place to talk about some science's process. I mean, the person I think of is Fred von Saul, who, when he first started his work, was I think in many in the scientific community, I'm going to use a really technical term here, viewed as a nut job because the claims he was making were so far afield from what the general consensus was. So, I mean, this is a place where we could actually help our listeners, readers, and viewers understand a little bit about the process of science, especially in a university setting. Dr. Lupo, in this sense, doesn't have to be the only or the singular example.
Well, and in fact, we have a vice provost at this very campus who believes that nuclear fusion is far more likely than some of the other folks in the scientific consensus. Lots of stories have been done about that. No lasting damage to his reputation, as far as I know. Yeah. Seems like the local media have an opportunity here. One other question about this, and Lee, I'll start with you. The Chronicle, in its story, the Chronicle of Higher Education, they ran the allegations before they ran any reaction from the folks who were accused. They accused six scientists mm-hmm. at six universities. Well, they had to issue a correction on Monday afternoon when one of those universities, Michigan Tech, said, you know, the scientist that they quoted here, our professor, he has not received any money and he has never had any contact with them. So did they practice good journalism by getting that story out there before they got the reaction?
Thanks for the softball, Mike. The answer to that would be no. Especially, I mean, the Chronicle is kind of like the insider base baseball for those of us in higher ed. And so especially when you're holding up by name someone for doing something that could be reputation damaging, you are absolutely obligated to call them, get their side of it, do everything that you can. And if all of those efforts are unsuccessful, I think you're obligated to say, we called, we phoned, we sent smoke signals, we did email, and there was no response.
Well, meanwhile, let's go back and revisit the piece of the story we were telling last week. And that involved the scientist Peter Gleick out in California, who admitted that he took the Heartland documents under false pretenses. He pretended to be a board member, and now there's been some allegations in the past week that he actually faked one of those documents. Now, he hasn't admitted that yet, but the conservative blogosphere has had a field day trying to prove it. And in fact, a lot of folks, Linda, on that side of the spectrum are comparing it to the controversy a few years ago when Dan Rather was caught using fake memos from the National Guard to try to prove up a story about George W. Bush.
Right. All I can say is so some of the writings that are already out there about this in the blogosphere really indicate that, well, not just blogosphere, the Atlantic Monthly, there's an article about that, and I think that's linked on the blog. It's pretty obvious that this document is different from other documents, and it was sent around so widely, and now Gleick has admitted to falsifying or had admitted to obtaining it under false pretenses.
He hasn't said that he hasn't faked
right,
the document.
He hasn't said that he faked the document. It just makes me sick. It makes me ill at how many different ways that people can lie and people can and people who believe so fervently in their views that they feel that they're justified in lying in order to further their own agenda and it makes me ill.
So, Lee, is it fair to compare this current situation with the Memogate controversy around Dan Rather, and will it have the same kind of impact?
Well, a couple of things. Dr. Gleick is not a journalist. So to break it back to us and make it really uncomfortable, I have two words for you. It's food lion all over again. That was the case where there were a bunch of journalists who, under false pretenses, got hired at a meatpacking plant, discovered that there was lots of unsavory things going on, to coin a pun, and wrote about it. What they reported was never alleged to be untrue. It was how they went about getting
exactly
the information that became the subject of the lawsuit itself and that ultimately resulted in a huge verdict in favor of Food Lion. This is exactly the same thing. And I'm with Linda. I don't like it, but I also know that journalists have done this and supposedly we're supposed to learn these lessons.
Well, and on this one, I don't think it rises to the level of Rathergate because the subject isn't as high a profile subject. We're not maligning a candidate or a citizen. sitting president. We're maligning other high officials.
We're aligning a client theory. Right.
I mean, so the process is the same. The impact is not as great.
All right. So let's move on to our second story this week. It involves the recent debate about whether the city council should declare wide swaths of Columbia a blighted area in order to qualify for a program that offers tax breaks to companies who want to start new businesses or relocate here. Well, local economic development officials have spearheaded this drive for what's called an economic enterprise zone. City and school district leaders have supported it. But there is a group of Columbia activists, many of whom live in the area to be described as blighted, who are upset by this thing. They worry that the designation will hurt the city's reputation, depress their property values, and even some are arguing that it opens the door for the city to use eminent domain in the future to condemn private property to help developers. Well, last Wednesday, some 70 of those activists got together at Parkade Center to air their concerns, and last night, the Downtown Leadership Council talked about the issue as well. Here's how KOMU introduced its story.
The Columbia Downtown Leadership Council talked about areas in Columbia for expanding business. KOMU8's Andrew Carter joins us to explain why adding new business sometimes can be controversial.
Angie, normally you won't find anyone against adding business or new jobs, but as I found out just a few hours ago, that isn't exactly the case here.
You know, and the whole story basically is about, well, isn't it funny that people would be complaining about an initiative that would lead to more jobs? Now, the television coverage, and KOMU is certainly not the only guilty party here, has really been very limited, sometimes wrong in my estimation. It's certainly not the nuanced approach that we would expect to take on an important local story. But Lee, it's hyper-local. It's very complicated. This says something about the need for at least the traditionally printed media to fill in the gaps, don't you think?
It says something about the need for the traditionally print media to fill in the gaps. It also says something about doing basic journalism. I would argue this story is about following the money. That's a hard thing to do in something like this because the money goes through lots of little turns and twists. But we talk about framing as a way of sort of putting a fence around a story and giving people a way to anchor it. One of the things that concerns me about the story, Mike, that you just saw, but also some of the stuff I've seen in the Trib, is this is really about following the money and whose pockets it's going to wind up in. Are we going to have tax breaks that are going to go to a certain group of folks? We've got other folks who are worried about their property values and eminent domain and all of those sorts of things. We've got a city that's sort of worried about growth, however you want to define that. And meanwhile, I bet I'm not the only person in the Columbia scratching my head going, blight? Really?
Enhanced Enterprise Zone? Really? EEZ? What does that mean exactly? Yeah.
And Linda, is this a story that local television news could tell well if it wanted to? Or is it one of those stories that really is best left for the printed media?
I feel like every episode of Views of the News is this stump the chump episode. And like, how are we going to, you know, work through these issues that we don't really know? We actually, I think it is one that TV could cover. I think I had some students who were working on this as a story just last week. They were not working on it from the issue of eminent domain and what people feared about the designation of blight on their property values. But they were working on it because there have already been numerous areas in the state of Missouri that have applied for this, who have had it in practice for a year. It is not that difficult to go to those communities and say, what new businesses opened? How many jobs were created? How did this work in your area? Who benefited? Where did the tax dollars go? And how did it work? And if it worked that way in your area, might it work that way in ours? I presume that's what Ready and our business owners have done. They've looked at that somewhat to see what the benefits are going to be. But until those benefits are researched and known by those of us who haven't researched them yet, I think that's a way to go.
Well, Lee, I want to take you back to the Tribune because you brought them up a moment ago. And one of the local independent journalists and bloggers, Mike Martin, who writes the Columbia Heartbeat, has been really harsh in his analysis of the Tribune. I mean, first of all, you have publisher and main editorial writer Hank Waters, who is a downtown property owner himself. His wife, Vicky, is on the board of Ready, the economic development organization that's pushing this whole enterprise zone and the need for a blighted designation. And he draws the conclusion that there is an obvious conflict of interest at the Tribune.
Well, I often agree with what Mr. Martin blogs about, and I think that there is an obvious conflict of interest at the Tribune. But the Tribune is a locally owned newspaper. I defy you to go to any other newspaper that actually exists in brick and mortar and say they're not a property owner, they don't have a stake in how the local business community does. We're conflicted of interest up the wazoo. That doesn't mean we can't do good reporting, and that doesn't mean we can't do evidence-based reporting. And certainly some of that evidence-based reporting, I would suggest, is like great for TV because you can have maps, you can have charts and graphs about what the tax breaks are and what the bill, not just to the homeowners in that area are, but the bill is to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. There's tons of stuff that TV and print could do with this.
I've got to say, though, not wanting to let the Tribune quite off the hook so easily, I mean, it seems to me that they've done a lot of coverage of this issue. Give them credit for that. Probably more column inches in print and online than anybody else. But if you look at their stories, and I've read, I think, every single one of them, they tend to provide a lot more quotes to the economic development community and political leaders than they do to opposition. In fact, there was a story about the opposition which quoted folks from outside of Columbia about eminent domain before in the very last paragraph they got to Carl Scala, a local person, activist, former city council member. I kind of think they might have gone a little overboard in not providing at least some level of equality to the opponents.
I think that's true. I agree, Mike. I also think that's true of a lot of articles in both of our newspapers in town, that they're sort of not as I was going to say that they're somewhat thinly reported. I don't think that we get as advanced reporting, and I think that part of that has to do with the people organizing, and that this organization and the Parkade meeting the other night will bring more of that viewpoint in. But it's not surprising to me.
I agree with Linda. What we've got here is a great case of source dependency, which I think is much worse on the local level. The people who, quote, know something and are in positions of authority are people who on this particular issue, not all issues, are kind of on one side. Mm-hmm. The folks who are less learned, less connected to, you know, economic development in a traditional way are the folks who are on the other side. As journalists, it would be we are prisoners of our sources. But that means we just got to work really hard to find those others.
But there are lawyers, journalists, and lots of other folks who are also concerned about – I mean, they may be wrong about whether the blighted designation will have all of those impacts. But it isn't just that they know less about the subject than the economic development community. And if you look at the Missourians' coverage, which has been far less total coverage, but they seem to have been a bit more balanced. And George Kennedy, columnist, professor here at the J School, went to that meeting of some 70 people last Wednesday and wrote a decidedly different and I'd say more balanced take on what happened. So at the very least, it suggests that we need to have more than one independent source of local news.
But I will tell you this, as learned as George is and as I think careful as he is about going out and sourcing his stories, when you get to the end of George's column, I don't have any more clear idea about whether eminent domain will or won't be applied to these blighted areas at the end of that story.
Right, but he gave voice and context to those folks without necessarily then tying it all up neatly at the end.
But this is a place where I actually think on this issue that eminent domain is a little bit of a tangential issue because it is the most legally troubling. It's the one that fits the neatest frame of government coming in and doing something that I, the individual citizen, don't like. I think the real story here and the much tougher one to get at, because eminent domain right now is speculative. These tax breaks are not speculative.
Right.
They're part of what we do in Missouri.
Let me move to one of our non-local stories. We're not going to give it much time today, but the newspapers in New York and New Jersey are coming in for some scrutiny as well for their editorial positions on what the New York Police Department has been doing, which is surveillance of area Muslims. And the Associated Press has been running an in-depth, exclusive series of reports starting back in August of last year about this program. Well, it turns out this week that the White House, we learn, has provided federal funds that helped pay for that program.
New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly defends the operation and maintains the NYPD will continue its intelligence efforts. Politicians from both sides of the Hudson have chimed in. New York Senator Chuck Schumer said he doesn't see anything wrong with the NYPD's efforts. And Governor Andrew Cuomo said he doesn't believe there's any reason to second-guess the NYPD's methods. While both New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Newark Mayor Cory Booker expressed concerns as to why they had no knowledge of the operation. Christie even asked New Jersey's attorney general to look into the matter to see if the NYPD reached outside of its jurisdiction.
Now, interestingly, the New York and New Jersey media have by and large reflected the views of their political leaders. For example, the New York Post and the Daily News have defended the surveillance program and the police. A Post columnist even described the Associated Press series as, quote, a journalistic jihad against the NYPD. Meanwhile, papers across the Hudson over in New Jersey have criticized it. And as the Huffington Post pointed out this week, the New York Times so far hasn't weighed in. Now, there's an interesting piece that because we're not going to get to much of this week, but I'd encourage you to read it. And Lee, I mean, is this just Homerism or what do you make of that?
I think, as usual, when we're doing public policy, we talk out of both sides of our mouth and don't realize that our mouth is actually connected. So in Missouri, for example, the police are required to report who they've stopped mm-hmm. by race, by gender, because we're concerned about that kind of racial profiling. So we're concerned over here, but we're perfectly comfortable with it in New York City. That didn't work for me.
I'd encourage you, by the way, we also have a link to all of the AP's stories going back to August of last year. And whether you agree or disagree with their, quote, attack, unquote, on the NYPD, it's a really enlightening series that you might want to take a look at. Well, finally, we'd like to remind you, as if you need it, that the True False Film Fest opens tomorrow with its ninth year of outstanding documentary films, including the film that's going to open the festival, Oscar winner Undefeated, which tells the story of a North Memphis high school football team.
Everybody says when you get these inner city kids down, they'll lay over and you'll beat them by 40. Not us. You got to believe in yourselves, fellas.
Boy, those guys have taken some beating here.
There's a Manassas player down.
God, I hope we didn't just lose him. Two things mean most anything to him in the world is his father and football. And we got to make sure we're there for him.
And if that's any indication of the quality of the films, and if history is any indication, Lee, it's going to be quite the next 4 days here in Columbia.
Oh, I'm so happy because I wait for this every year. So you asked me, Mike, to come up with some movies that I'm really interested in seeing, so I'm just going to list them. Obviously, this one, Half Revolution, which is about the Arab Spring, Building Babel, which is about the mosque near Ground Zero and the controversy over that. Bully, which is about some kids in Ohio who have been bullied in ways that I think I at least can barely imagine. That one's supposed to be tough viewing. How to Survive a Plague, which is done with a lot of archival footage about the early days of ACT UP in New York and age activism. And then Detropia, which is supposed to be a pretty unvarnished look at Detroit and whether or not it's actually having any sort of an urban renaissance.
I would just say that listen to Lee's list. It sounds fabulous. I'm kind of an all or nothing person, and unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to get to as many movies as I'd like this weekend, but I'll be doing a lot of volunteering. So
I'd also point out that there are a couple of events that the journalism school is involved with that are sort of part of True False, including tonight. There is a program where, and it starts tonight, moves through the next couple of days, looking at the relationship between traditional documentaries and journalism. Encourage you to find out more about that online. And also the Third Coast documentary folks, audio documentary folks, are coming in from Chicago. They'll be part of True False. They're going to play these radio stories while in a darkened theater, and that could be a pretty interesting setup as well. Well, that's going to wrap up this week's show. If you'd like to watch or listen again, you can comment on the program or even find stories linked to our topics by going to our website and clicking on the talk shows tab at kbia.org. We'd also like to welcome your comments via email at views@kbia.org. Thanks to our technical team this week, as always, RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. Thanks as well to Lee and Linda for their thoughts. I'm Mike McKean. Join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.